Hello and welcome to the South Carolina Lead. You trust the lead to keep you up to date on important state news, and we've been doing that more often as our state faces the COVID-19 virus.
We in a pandemic!
I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on August 24th, 2020, from my home studio here in Columbia. Just so you know, some of the information in this podcast may have changed by the time you've heard it. This podcast cuts through the noise and gives you South Carolina-specific COVID-19 news and stories. This episode features the latest on the issues faced in the U.S. Postal Service, with some comments from our congressional delegation. I speak with State Superintendent of Education Molly Spearman, Governor Henry McMaster participates in the Republican National Convention, MUSC is working on an app that will let you know if you came into contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19, and we have much more in this episode, including in our wind-down section, where we may be talking Hobbs and Shaw for real. Stick around. Additionally, we want to hear your stories, so we set up a voicemail box to hear from you all about your daily life in these uncertain times. Leave us a 1 to 3 minute long voicemail with your name and where you're calling from at 803-563-7169. I'm also really interested in hearing from, you know, UPS or FedEx delivery drivers. You know, I want to know more about just how crazy it is out there since everyone's just been ordering stuff online. So if you're listening, you're out there driving, feel free to give us a shout. You don't have to tell us who you work for. Just let me know what it's like out there. 803-563-7169. Now for the latest in South Carolina. Currently, the spread of COVID-19 is ongoing, widespread, and not contained, according to Department of Health and Environmental Control officials. There have been 2,387 deaths, and currently there are 111,202 cases being reported in all 46 counties as of August 24th at 4 p.m. Our most recent percent positive rate was 13.3%. Again, that number is somewhat lower, but it's still above 10%, and ideally would be below 5%. We want to get to that kind of area, but we haven't been there in a long time. But some other good news, there are currently 979 people hospitalized with COVID-19, 248 are in intensive care, and 148 are ventilated. That's good news only because those numbers continue to decline. So please keep up the good work out there, people. Wear your mask, wash your hands, avoid crowds. Come on. Be safe on Labor Day. Be smart. Avoid crowds. Wash your hands. Over the weekend, the U.S. House of Representatives approved $25 billion for the U.S. Postal Service and voted to restore operations back to January levels. Before this vote, House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn spoke on the floor with similar tones from earlier in the week on safeguarding the USPS ahead of the election. Here's a bit of what Clyburn had to say.
Businesses exist to make profits. The Post Office and the whole of our government exist to provide services. That is why it is called the Postal Service, not the Postal Corporation. Today, we are acting to reinforce our Postal Service system, which provides vital services like delivering medications, Social Security benefits, income and tax payments, veterans benefits, census forms, and absentee ballots to all American communities, however remote they may be. Americans' dependence on the Postal Service has dramatically increased during this pandemic, as we have watched the on-time delivery of mail decrease significantly.
Now, President Donald Trump urged a no vote and railed on Twitter against mail-in ballots, which he expects to surge in the COVID-19 crisis. Trump also said he wants to block extra funds to the Postal Service. The AP reports that White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows dismissed the bill as, quote, going nowhere, while Pelosi urged the GOP-controlled Senate to act quickly. She said, the public is demanding action on this now. I can't see how the Senate can avoid it unless they do so to their peril. 5th District Republican Congressman Ralph Norman, the only other member of the South Carolina delegation to speak ahead of the vote, started off by calling the vote a total sham and said House leadership still had, quote, Trump derangement syndrome.
If the Democrats are so concerned, then why have we not had a hearing about the Postal Service issues since June 15th of 2019? If the Democrats are so concerned, why have we not had round-the-clock meetings to discuss a bill that we intend to fund the $25 billion which is being proposed? We have been out of session for 17% of the time since March 15th. Why haven't we been called back in to discuss? If you do the math on $25 billion, we've got 70 days left. That's roughly $325 million per day. You tell the American taxpayer where you're spending that money. You tell the American taxpayer how we're going to come up with it. You tell the American taxpayer this is like dropping money from a helicopter. If the Democrats are so concerned about the post office, why are we having the vote today when the Postmaster General is appearing at the hearing on Monday? This is just like determining the score of a football game and then playing the game on Monday. It makes no sense.
Now, the bill heads of the Senate, where Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he supports a $10 billion postal rescue in the next COVID relief bill, but said the Senate will not consider standalone legislation, again, according to the AP. Moving on, State Superintendent of Education Molly Spearman sat down with me on This Week in South Carolina via Skype last Friday. I opened by asking Spearman about how this school year will look different, and we also talked about the politics around school reopenings and her relationship with Governor McMaster.
Number one, we're in a better place with access to the internet. We can talk about that, but we're delivering hotspots. Over 80,000 are being delivered as we speak to make sure that families do have internet connection. There's been a lot of training for teachers to be able to teach virtually more successfully. How do you engage with the students? We've even trained parents on the devices and how they can help. So everyone should be in a much better place than they were. So the expectation is higher. And we will, as I said, be taking attendance. Students must turn in their work. They must check in every day. And we have purchased a learning management system licensure, over 650,000 licensures for teachers and families in the state where students can connect, receive their homework assignments, turn those in. So we're in a much better place to manage all of this and to keep account of what's going on.
You're talking about accountability and keeping in touch. One of the big issues we saw at the tail end of last school year was a lot of missing students, some thousands of them. Can you give us an update about that, where we maybe stand right now and how, again, you're gonna counteract that this year and make sure that all the students are accounted for?
Well, I think that was the difference, that we were unable to do a daily attendance count with students. So those numbers are down to, we turned in about 3,200 names. We're working very closely with the Department of Social Services. They are now in the process of contacting families for those that we absolutely could not reach. So I feel much better. And I think as students are now coming back to register for the new school year, we'll be able to make those final contacts. And knowing that some of those families have moved out of South Carolina, so we'll have a better understanding of all those numbers shortly. All districts should be started by September 8th, so we should really have a very good count on that.
And that'll be something you guys really keep on top of.
Absolutely.
I know that's been a big issue for lawmakers too, but Superintendent, when we look at some of these plans that have been approved, and you know this is all being implemented at the local level, there's the oversight from the Department of Education. At what point do you feel like the Department of Education would need to intervene in a school district when it comes to implementing these plans? Maybe, for example, something's happening with five-day-a-week instruction face-to-face, teachers aren't feeling comfortable, they're voicing their opinions, but maybe aren't feeling heard. They reach out to your office. What could happen if we see some needed oversight here for these plans?
Well, we have established several different protocols for not only teachers, but parents, if they're concerned, to call us at the Department of Education, speak with our ombudsman. We will then contact the superintendent in the school. And that even includes things like, we don't think they're carrying out the protocols for protective equipment or whatever it might be, but working very, very closely with those local districts. I hope that we don't have to intervene with any type of financial withholding funds. That is within our realm at a very small percentage, and I don't want to go there because that's certainly very strict and I don't want to overreact, but I am working daily with superintendents and with local school boards to ensure that we are putting into action all the plans that we've said we're going to do.
But were you surprised to see just how political it did get this summer when we came to discussing how schools are going to reopen? You know, we had the governor go out and say that he wanted to see 5-day-a-week education instruction face-to-face. You weren't at that press conference. You guys spoke before it. He even had the vice president down here backing up his plan. Were you surprised that it became so political? And did any of that influence your decision going forward in approving any of these plans?
Well, it didn't change my decision for sure. And I guess I wasn't surprised because at a national level, it became obvious that there was pressure for all schools to open. And I understand that because we do need to get back to school. The kids need to be there. Parents need us to help them be able to go to work. So it is a tough, tough comp, but it's a very complex issue. And you cannot answer it with every school's got to open 5 days a week. You cannot do that. So I stuck to my guns. And got some praise, got some criticism, but it did not change how I reacted because my job is to make sure and serve the people of South Carolina in the best interests of public education. That's what I was elected to do as a state constitutional officer. So, yes, it has gotten a little political, but I'm still trying to make the right decision based on all the data that I have.
And finally, the Republican National Convention kicked off in Charlotte on Monday. Delegates met in person for party business, including the roll call votes. Governor McMaster pledged all 50 delegates to reelecting the 45th President, Donald Trump. Here is Governor McMaster.
Madam Secretary, I'm Henry McMaster, delegate and governor of the great state of South Carolina, where my wife Peggy and I are proud owners of two of Mike Lindell's pillars. South Carolina is also the home of the first in the South Republican primary, presidential primary. We were settled in 1670, and if Donald Trump had been around then, we'd have voted for him then. So today we proudly and happily cast all 50 of our votes for President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. Thank you.
Senator Tim Scott and former governor and former U.S. UN ambassador Nikki Haley will speak Monday evening. We'll have their remarks in Thursday's podcast. And we're changing the script a little bit for our business section today. It's actually our book review section. As we wrap up celebrations for the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which secured the right to vote predominantly for white women, since black and indigenous women weren't fully guaranteed that right until 1965, I wanted to include this conversation I had with Christina Woolbrick, political science professor at the University of Notre Dame and co-author of A Century of Votes for Women. We spoke on This Week in South Carolina via Skype, and I started by asking her about that racially divisive history around women's rights to vote.
It's important to emphasize what the 19th Amendment does and doesn't do. The Constitution actually says very little about voting, and what the 19th Amendment says, or at least it did originally, is that you cannot discriminate in voting rights on the basis of sex. It's literally the same language as the 15th Amendment that says you cannot discriminate in voting rights on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. But the 19th Amendment, by saying you can't discriminate on the basis of sex, did literally nothing to push back against exactly what you said, the sort of long traditions of voter suppression and barriers to black people voting in the South during this period. The truth is, voting regulations and voting administration happens at the state levels. And even in 1920, as you mentioned, the states really varied in how much they wanted to accommodate women. So some states held special registration days and expanded hours in the evening and all this information to help women learn how to vote. Just, you know, what do you do when you get into the polling place? Other states, as you mentioned, this was a period in which many had very long registration deadlines. You had to register 6 months in advance. There were four southern states that said, oh, well, it's the end of August when this thing got ratified, and you guys didn't register to vote back then, and so we're sorry, you can't vote in November 1920, you'll have to wait for the next election.
Mm-hmm. And so how have black women become more of a powerhouse when it comes to voting? Women in general, obviously white women, I think in your book you point out that they vote in greater numbers, but black women are not far behind that. What's the state of play in that regard when we look at both white and black women?
So first, I want to make sure to acknowledge that even before 1965, there were some black women in the South who were able to overcome these barriers. So I want to acknowledge the barriers were huge, but also give credit to those women. Since 1965 and the Voting Rights Act, we've seen the percentage of African Americans in general and black women specifically in turnout accelerate dramatically. And as you said, the only group that turns out at a higher rate than black women now is white women, and those differences are really small. And this is actually quite remarkable to see a group that's faced these barriers now turning out at such very high levels.
Mm-hmm. It kind of gives the state of play right now. You know, you've outlined the book from the beginning to when we see 1970, which was the 50-year anniversary, things really started changing, to the gender gap in 1980. Where are we right now in terms of issues facing women and the role that they play in presidential elections specifically?
So one of the things that I think makes women voters even more important today than they've been in the past is how very close our elections are. And so you can have turnout differences, and you can have even vote choice differences. But if, you know, 60% of women vote for party X and 70% of men vote for party X, that's a gender gap, but they're still on the same side. But now our elections, time after time, we've seen this, right? The Electoral College vote coming out different than the popular vote. Boy, our elections are very narrowly decided now, and women's high turnout and the fact that there's just more women in the eligible electorate because we live so long makes them a really key demographic, a really diverse demographic, right? So we have to recognize that women vote in lots of different ways, but a really important one.
And Professor Wolberg, we have just a minute left, and there's so much to talk about. Again, there's so much great information in your book. I found it very fascinating reading it. But I want to ask you right now, I'd be remiss if I didn't, just what you think about a woman of color, Senator Kamala Harris, being on the ticket now of a major party. What do you think might happen, how this might shape this election when we see women turning out to vote?
You know, the 19th Amendment is fundamentally about whether or not women are direct, independent political actors. And so Kamala Harris as the nominee is just another example of how far we've come in those sorts of ways. The depressing political science downer news I'm going to give you is that vice presidential choices don't usually change a lot of votes. Mm-hmm. Although I think in this case, the package of the two and the message that that's sending may well be a very powerful mobilizer.
You can watch that entire episode on our YouTube page at youtube.com/South Carolina ETV. And just so you know, the South Carolina Board of Economic Advisors met Monday, and we'll have a full recap of everything they talked about in Thursday's podcast. The Senate reopened South Carolina Select Committee met last week to discuss a new COVID-19 exposure notification app that is being developed by MUSC, Apple, and Google. Now, this app is not contact tracing. It would just notify you if you happen to have come into contact with someone who has tested positive. MUSC President Bob Cole explains.
If this room of people had an app, if we all had this app, and let's say that I tested positive 2 days from now, I became symptomatic, I got a fever, I went and got tested. If we were all chose to participate, when I got notified, and by the way, connects to the reporting and testing that we're doing now as a state. So when my test comes to my phone, again, in a HIPAA-compliant manner, I have a choice to make. I can say, thank you very much, I appreciate the information, it tells me how to contact my doctor, what the next steps are. But you can also choose, as an individual, to say, I want this for the public good, and flip that switch. And what that does is, in a totally anonymous manner, does not identify who you are, where you are, or anything like that, but it knows by Bluetooth technology who you were near for how long, when. And so it's not just some random person wandering down the street. If I had a very close conversation with Jim Clements for 20 minutes, standing within a risk range of him, if I turned positive, his app would say, it would notify him and say, Jim, you're at risk. And here's who you contact. And if you're high enough risk, maybe you should consider getting tested or not. So it's an exposure notification application that's really focused on the individual in terms of what they can provide and what they can do. It's, to me, an enabling technology.
Again, this app will work off of Bluetooth and not GPS. It doesn't upload any data to a central database or anything like that. See TikTok. But while there are many apps out there that deal with notifications and the like, such an app needs to be created in the state. That's what Bob Cole says.
Specifically for the state of South Carolina, it's important to understand that Apple, Google, as an international consortium, right, a partnership there, requires for an app of this nature, whatever version of it is, to be endorsed and supported by the state public health entity. So there will or will not be an app in the state of South Carolina based on, you know, whether or not the state chooses to endorse some version of this. Everything's in the details. So the app that we've started from path one has been carefully crafted to meet what we feel to be the highest purpose with the least risk for our citizens. So they're not all the same. You can read about somebody else and somebody else doing something. That's not, it's all in the details. And what we're doing will or will not be deployed for the state of South Carolina. It's not like we can go somewhere else and get this from Georgia, Alabama or not. It's very specifically, and we've had a gazillion conversations with Apple, Google leadership. So that would be the another layer of that question. Why not, you know, why bother? Because it ain't gonna happen otherwise.
And again, if you're one of those people worried about being tracked, if you have that phone in your pocket, you already are. So going forward, just think about how effective this app could be if we pair it with rapid results from places like USC with its new rapid saliva testing and contact tracing. So things like this will be beneficial once they come out, and we'll have a lot of positive benefits to help calm down on some of these outbreaks and these clusters of COVID-19. Now, this is our wind-down section where we want to hear from you. Tell us what's happening in your world. Again, like I said earlier, if you're a delivery driver, give us a shout. You don't have to say who you work for, but I'm just interested in just hearing how chaotic things are right now. I've heard some reports about just people having to work overtime or on days off. And maybe that's your job and you're not a delivery driver. Tell us what's going on with you, too. We're interested. 803-563-7169. Just leave us your name, where you're calling from, and what's happening. And AT, with that being said, do we have any new voicemails to check out?
We have our last voicemail of this big backup like we've had for the past few days. We've got a student from the University of South Carolina, Go Cox, calling in. So this should be interesting. Let's roll the tape.
Roll tape, please.
Hi, my name is Richard Dorman Jr. I'm a rising junior political science major at the University of South Carolina. Tonight is Thursday, the 20th. The final night of convention, and I'm also a college student who's just recently moved into the University of South Carolina. I'm very excited for convention as I was elected as a at-large pledge delegate for Joe Biden at this year's convention. Wish I could be in Milwaukee, but, you know, watching this convention tonight, it's been great for the past three nights, and I'm pumped and ready to go for the election this coming November, and I'm just excited. But also, as a student, I'm looking around myself, and so far here at the University of South Carolina, I've been seeing a lot of people with their masks on and everything, and social distancing has been going all right, but still, as a student as well, seeing what just happened at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and a couple other schools around the United States of America, can't say I'm the most optimistic about our prospects of how long we'll be staying here on campus. That being said, I love being here back at USC. Love having my freedom back, I reckon I could say. Glad that I have at least some classes that are in person. But we'll see what goes on in the next few weeks and see how long this lasts. Huge fan of y'all's show, and thank y'all so much. Have a good day.
Thanks for calling, Richard. We appreciate your perspective. We love hearing from college students, especially as you guys are going back, like you said. I'm hoping to speak with someone from USC this week on This Week in South Carolina on my show this week. So we'll find out more. I know they're doing better with those rapid saliva tests, so that's exciting to see. And hopefully it doesn't become UNC Chapel Hill, you know? But you never know. I mean, this thing is fast. And like you were saying, AT, before we get into our Hobbs and Shaw's conversation, conversation, you were talking about driving through Five Points recently and your wife driving through the Vista, and it just looking like
they boom, were boom, both, boom. They just looked like everything was regular. So hopefully they can figure out where those clusters are and keep them contained, mm-hmm. and it doesn't blow up like it has in all those other universities around the country.
Yeah, because the problems have been with the off-campus situations that then
every
cause
time
a big outbreak,
every single
big clusters. So, be safe out there, guys. Come on, be party smart, party safe. Now,
but
the biggest conversation
it, okay?
we've been all waiting for.
The conversation that has it has been weeks in the making. Weeks, people.
Just the suspense and the drama. I mean, it's almost like as suspenseful as that movie I just watched. Or I watched.
He's bearing the lead again here that he film. Watched it. He's experienced this film. Yeah. Okay.
I experienced this film. And let me just curate some notes I have for you.
Yeah, he took notes. This is exactly
I had
right.
To,
he
because he they're just so... You know, I'll start off with this, AT, like I told you. You know, this movie isn't as insane, any more insane than the insane movies that are out there. Like, think of your Mission Impossibles. Think of...
I wrote this down. If he,
any
if
of
Gavin,
thrillers,
if you,
you know?
Think this is like a Mission Impossible movie, I say it's like a Mission Impossible movie written by an eighth grade boy.
Sure. Yeah, I would say that. Like, you know, your Mission Impossible, even though we're all like on this like spectrum of just insanity when it comes to these plots and these effects.
Yeah.
At least Mission Impossible, I don't know, it's like a little bit higher, a little bit more curated level.
It's like a grown human wrote it.
Sophisticated.
It's like it was written by a middle schooler.
Yes.
But in the best way possible.
There's just so much that happens in it. And it, you know, then you have like the reunion at the end in America and Samoa, and you're just like, what is.
Let's talk favorite scenes here. Let's talk favorite scenes, okay? What's the high note for you?
I'll say one of the most ridiculous situations that I was struck by was this car chase scene where The Rock holds his arm out the window and clotheslines and gets this guy by the throat. I was on a motorcycle. He just stopped him with his own brute strength. He was probably going 60 miles an hour, just stopped him, held on to him, and then slammed him into a wall.
Yeah, with his arm out of a McLaren, which is a one-person car that they had three people in.
Yes. Oh, technical note.
Yeah, that's right. I got a lot of behind-the-scenes info.
Yeah. So, yeah, I did like their dynamic, you know, Jason Statham and The Rock. They were pretty funny. There was a lot of great one-liners. It wasn't too hokey. It could have been. It would have been in some other movies, but it was enough to keep it going. Then you had Ryan Reynolds and, like, you know, the
Ryan Reynolds
Helen Mirren cameo.
Reynolds is the sneaky best part of this movie. That was my note that I wrote down to talk to you about. He kills a man with a brick.
Sharp edge. Yeah, because Idris Elba is like this... It's a cyborg again, so we're just kind of keeping with our Terminator summer here.
He's somewhere between Superman and Terminator, you know?
Yes.
And he's unstoppable. He's an unstoppable force that these two men must work together to defeat.
Yes. And Vanessa Kirby, who played
Hattie.
Yeah, she is. Well, I like her a lot because she was Princess Margaret on The Crown.
She's really slumming it in this action movie.
Yeah. But she's a great actress and I dig her, so I was glad to see her in something else.
I do too, yeah. Me too.
And then there's a drone chase scene towards the end.
Yep, drone chase.
The most ridiculous scene is when they are back in American Samoa. The Rock is reunited with his family because he sold out.
Seen in decades.
He sold them out because he turned the father in because the father was a crook, and then he had to reunite, and then they had to kind of come together to fight the final stand against like Idris and like this other organization that he represents as they try to wipe out the human race, the weak ones, with this virus. I will say it is very reminiscent, the plot is very reminiscent of Mission Impossible 2 with the Chimera virus.
So bad, that movie.
But I'll watch those any day of the week. So I mean, I would watch this again. I wouldn't pay for it, but I would watch it again.
It's on HBO.
Turns out I had seen parts of it already.
Yeah.
I think my dad and my stepmom were watching it. So
you were saying that this movie was not very Fast and Furious to you. And
yes,
and
you wouldn't even know it was associated.
It's definitely furious, you know? It's not really fast.
There's a lot of fury.
It's definitely furious. And I was telling you I had some background info on this, and the reason this movie even exists, the only reason this really exists, is that The Rock and Vin Diesel cannot stand each other. And so they were like, well, we love The Rock in these movies. We need to create a vehicle for him because Vin Diesel won't work with him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why this movie exists. And I love it for that.
Yeah. And there's some great chemistry between The Rock and Jason Statham, because there's some great one-liners and they just like pick on each other, and it's not overly done, so I can appreciate that. I was fearful, maybe because of the Fast and Furious title, Fast and Furious Presents, and how we always talk about it, and I'm just kind of sick of that franchise. But without Vin Diesel in it, it makes it, you know, it's palatable.
It's still about family. Let's be real. It's still about family.
We brought it home at the end there, totally. The family. It's still about family. The helicopter scene was just, he actually had to hold on a chain at one point to hold onto a helicopter while holding onto a pickup truck, like a big rig.
Okay. Let's talk about this one part here that has irked me. I've told you and I've told Meg. So before he holds the helicopter, there is like a haka, like a Samoan haka. And it's The Rock and his extended family, all shirtless in sarongs, intimidating these armed people.
Yes.
And then The Rock needs to run to go hold a helicopter. And in that time, he, for some reason, puts a shirt on.
Yeah, he switches from his sarong to his pants and has his shirt. And he gets his shirt back on.
The Rock, what are you doing? You're supposed to stay shirtless. That's your whole deal. The muscles.
I was confused about that. Like, why the need to, shed his... You know, the clothing of his people.
It's also a slow motion shirt grab and fluid motion put on, which would
they wanted you
CGI.
To know that he was changing.
And it was like it's basically one of your Old Navy American flag shirts, isn't it?
It was very similar. I was like, oh, I know that shirt.
Spoiler alert, Gavin owns an unnatural amount of just Old Navy American flag shirts that say Old Navy.
I own enough of normal people, and normal people have flag shirts. Old Navy. I mean, I haven't got a new one. I haven't got a new one since 2016.
You go, yeah, I got this in 2016. I go, yeah, I know. It says
I can see it. Well, I did it ironically, obviously. You can see the date.
And a story. I was right. This movie's great. How many stars are you giving it out of five? Out of six. Let's give it a possibility of six stars here. Let's flip the script. Six stars.
I mean, I can't go more than like three.
Three?
How can I go more than three?
I mean, it's a fiver. Five stars.
I mean, for like, in general, like, are we comparing it to like the best of the best?
We're talking about like the movie action. The movie you watched at this time. It transports you. You forget you're in a pandemic while you're watching this big, stupid movie. Come on. It deserves better than a 50% rating from you. You said you'd watch it again.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's good.
Four stars? You're insulting yourself right now.
Four out of six? I mean, three and a half?
So harsh.
I mean, when you compare it to Mission Impossible, which I would give a 4.5, I mean, now you're trying to say, what are you going to give Mission Impossible movies, a 5?
I think this movie was better than Mission Impossible 2. This movie is better than Mission Impossible 2. Mission Impossible 2 is a bad movie.
Any of the Mission Impossibles was what I'm saying. I mean, we're comparing these genres. So
Mission Impossible 1 is great. Mission Impossible 2 is bad. 3 is fine. And then the ones that are now that
Rogue
are kind of just like
Ghost Protocol. Yeah,
they're kind of like Scientology recruitment videos also. Like those are good. I feel bad about liking them all, but they're good.
I mean, but then you talk about crazy things. I mean, you had Tom Cruise on the side of a cargo plane. I mean, that was pretty crazy. Granted, he wasn't holding onto the cargo plane and also holding onto a car.
He wasn't holding
a
helicopter up. Yeah. It's crazy to say that, but that is a little bit more believable than this. But I also like that heightened sense of reality that these Fast and Furious extended universe movies bring.
I'm just glad that it had nothing to do with it besides the family aspect of it, which did not include Vin Diesel.
There was a lack of fast cars. I will say that. That's my one demerit from this.
Only at the end did you get those like cuts like Fast and Furious from the Brothers Cars. So again, check it out. It's on you said it's on HBO. You can rent it on Amazon. Thank you, Meg, for letting me use your Amazon so I could view the purchased video that you were forced to purchase. But now we've got some wear out of it, so that's good. Check it out. You might like it. Also, you know, you can also read a book. I've been reading some good thrillers. You don't need all the fake effects. You have your imagination.
This movie negates the reason for books to exist.
If anything, I want to read more now. We'll talk about some books that I just finished up too that you might be interested in the next pod. So check it out. Also, just so you know, Republican National Convention coverage from the PBS NewsHour starts Monday night. This is Tuesday, but we'll be having it on air through Thursday and online. Each day, NewsHour will host 10:30 a.m. preview online via Twitter and Facebook. You can catch the NewsHour at 6 p.m., and then pre-convention coverage begins at 7. And from 8 to 11 p.m., there will be special coverage of the convention. So tune in to your SCE TV stations and also public radio stations. And thanks for listening to the pod. You can show us appreciation by leaving us a review or a voicemail at 803-563-7169. Stay up to date with the latest news on scetv.org and southcarolinapublicradio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. Also consider becoming an ETV member. Membership starts at just $40, and if you pledge at the $75 level, you get access to PBS Passport and all the great programming your donation helps support. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina.
When they're just getting punched in the face by a Terminator superhero, man.
Yeah.
You know? Come on!
Oh, now we have to start working together. Like, okay. What were you doing before?
A lesson was learned. A lesson was learned.
Brother? Like, oh, okay, brother. Like,